Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what CURE does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. Heather Von St. James knows she isn't the typical mesothelioma survivor. At 36, she was balancing taking care of her newborn baby with her work as a popular hairstylist when she was diagnosed with this rare cancer that occurs in the lining of the lungs. After being told she only had 15 months to live without treatment, Heather traveled to Boston from Minneapolis for cancer treatment. She has been cancer-free for 17 years. In today's episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast, Heather explains what it's like to navigate an older person's disease as a younger woman.
We're 20, 30 years younger than everybody in this room.
Her journey from patient to advocate and blogger.
There's a nonprofit that I volunteer with that provides that community for people, and that's the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation.
Her experiences seeking legal action against the companies that contributed to asbestos exposure in her father's workplace.
We had to go to court. It was over 2 years after I filed.
Her advice for other patients with mesothelioma.
I encourage every mesothelioma victim to file a lawsuit with a reputable law firm.
And more.
I know you're a 16-year survivor, right?
Almost 17, going on 17 in November.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I read online that when you had, had your child, that's when all these really pretty intense symptoms began. How long did it take for you to get diagnosed after you started talking about all these symptoms to your doctors?
It was about just a little over a month. It wasn't that long.
Okay.
So I was very, very lucky. I started, it's like during the whole pregnancy, I had only gained 5 pounds.
I mean, weren't they worried about that?
It should have been a red flag, but I was heavier. I weighed 225 pounds when I got pregnant, but I'm tall. I was 5'10". So, it's like I was taller. I was a bigger girl. They didn't know there's... they're like, you're working and you're eating healthy. The baby is growing fine. It's not unheard of to not gain weight. So, as long as the baby's functioning, growing and there's no signs of fetal injury, you should be fine. So yeah, only 5 pounds through the whole pregnancy, which hindsight is 2020 that was a red flag. But
at the time,
it really wasn't. My doctor was not concerned at all. So, but after I had a C-section,
mm-hmm.
And then after I had the baby, I just never really got better. I just kept getting worse and worse. And I'm tired anyways, because I've got this new baby that's up all night. So I got a 4-week-old baby and I'm going back to work part-time. And while I'm working, I was just exhausted. And I was just I have a new baby. It's normal. So I called the doctor and made an appointment, went in, and he's like, you're really anemic. So that could explain the pallor and your breathlessness and why you're not getting your oxygen. And he goes, so your heart could be enlarged. And he goes, I want to, do some blood work and take a chest x-ray. So he does blood work and he comes back from the blood work. He's like, there's stuff that's off here. And they do a chest x-ray, and that's when they saw the mass and the pleural effusion. And he's like, he goes, you've got the fluid around your lung. He goes, that would explain why you're, short of breath. He goes, you need to go down to the hospital in St. Paul and have that drained. The doctor comes in and I got everything set up, and he jabs the needle in my back and starts pulling the fluid off. And he's like, there's a lot of fluid and it's a very odd color. He goes, usually fluid's kind of straw colored and this is more like the color of tea. He's like, that's not right. We need to send you for a CT scan to get this checked. During the doctor comes and he's like, we found something. He's like, I don't know what it is. We need to do more, biopsy to find out. It could be a blood clot or it could be a tumor. And then he called us after 2 weeks and he said, I want you guys to come in on Monday. Both you and your husband, we need to talk. So we go in and he's like, cancer is usually named after where it originates.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, sometimes you get breast cancer, but it shows up in the liver, or you can have kidney cancer show up in the spine. And I was like, okay, what do I have? He's like, you have a cancer called mesothelioma. Mm-hmm. It's in the lining of your lung. And I'm like, Where have I heard that before? And my husband just sits back and goes, oh my God, this is bad. And then the doctor asked me, he goes, did you or your father ever work around asbestos? I said, well, my dad was a construction worker when I was growing up, and he did a lot of drywall, and he did a lot of concrete, and he did a lot of demolition. And then he was a fireman. He was a volunteer fireman. So he was going into buildings, right, you know, all over town, you know, during fires and after fires. And it's like, yeah, you did construction. And then the doctor goes on to say, you were exposed to asbestos, and that's the only really cause of mesothelioma. But they didn't, they tried to ban it completely, but, you know, the chloralkali industry, and they were all like, no, we can't ban it. So
it's not even banned even today.
No.
So people can still use it. So you get this diagnosis, and then I gather from reading online that they did this incredible surgery where they took out your was it your left lung?
Yep. Yeah. So the doctor told us, he's like, well, you have three choices. You can have just do nothing and live maybe 15 months. And I was like, not an option. I have a new baby. He's like, okay, you could do chemo and radiation and hopefully you would get 5 years. I'm like, still not an option. I have a baby. And he's like, well, or you can do this surgery. And, you know, it's still really kind of newer, and but it's probably your best bet since you're young, and it's have your whole lung removed. And you know, but you'd have to go to Boston to have this. Okay. And my husband's like, get us to Boston. My doctor, his name is Dr. Flink, F-L-I-N-K. He took care of everything. James Flink. Oh my God, I still, whether it was a God thing or whether it was karma or the universe coming together, I don't know. But I was at the right place with the right doctors. And he took care of everything. He called Boston. He got me the appointment in Boston. He called my insurance company, took care of everything for us, and got us everything out there. And so next thing I know, 12 days later, 10 days later, we're all on our way to Boston. They had an orientation for new patients. It was such an amazing program, still is. So they had a new orientation for patients. And here my husband and I are sitting there, and we're 20, 30 years younger than everybody in this room.
Because it's like an old, it's considered like a person's disease.
Especially, you know, 17 years ago, it's like sitting in this room full of people in their 70s and 80s. I felt like a 12-year-old.
Did it mean that you had had a really big exposure, that you got sick when you were so young? Was it just that it was a long time ago? And 20 years, if you were 12, or then that would be the time that it would show up?
Yeah. They don't really know. Yeah. There's still such a mystery around why person A will get it, yet person B will be exposed to just as much or more, and they won't.
Did any of your siblings get it?
Nope. My sister's fine. My mom is still alive. My mom's doing fine. But I spent a lot more time with my dad because I was younger. You know, my sister was in middle school or junior high and high school, and you know, they're too cool for parents at that age. But he would come home, and this coat would be covered in this grayish, crusty dust. That's the only thing they can figure is that, you know, is this exposure and this, you know, and I used to go with my dad in his car, and his car was all dusty and gross. But his coat used to hang on a doorknob in our entryway. And, you know, I would just grab it and go get the mail, or grab it and go feed my rabbits, or, you know, go play in the leaves or whatever. Yeah. So we go to Boston and go through all the testing and everything to find out if indeed I'm a candidate for the surgery. They tested, you know, so it hadn't spread. It was still just located in the lower left part of my lung. So I was able to have the surgery, and I scheduled the surgery for February 2nd, 2006. That was when I had the surgery.
And it was a really long procedure too.
Yeah, it's like all day long. My poor, you know, we're there by ourselves, and they have this family room, this, you know, where the waiting area where all the family goes and sits and waits. And they took me back and did the surgery.
So was the recovery really hard?
I was in the hospital for 18 days because I had kidney troubles. My kidneys failed and they weren't functioning. So they're like, well, you're going to have to do dialysis. I was like, I refuse that. I do not need dialysis. My body will start working. It's like they came in the next morning to test my blood, and my creatinine levels dropped. So like, oh, your kidneys are working again. I was like, yay! Yes. And the hospital for 18 days. My husband had to come home because he had to go back to work. We still had bills to pay.
Right.
And my sister kind of took over for him, and she came to stay with me. So I recovered for 2 weeks in Boston. Then I flew to my parents' house because Lucius was living with my mom and dad at the time, mm-hmm. because that was the only thing we could think of, because I didn't want him being shuffled, you know, between a bunch of people. I wanted stability for him more than anything.
Right.
I was gone for his whole 6 months. And during that time, he took his first step and
he
rolled over and sat up his first time and was crawling. And because when I left him, he wasn't doing any of that.
So like, I know you had, like, you know, chemo and radiation. Was that all after you recovered? Okay.
Yep.
Their hospitals do the surgery?
Yes. There are doctors that still do the surgery, but they really shied away from doing the entire lung removal. They just don't do it anymore unless it's a very rare case.
So they wouldn't have done that for you if you would have been diagnosed in more recent years?
Yeah, they probably would have just taken the lining.
Oh, okay.
And they do, it's called a pleurectomy decortication, where they just take the lining and they leave the lung intact.
Do you have any long-term side effects from all of this?
How much time do you have?
Really?
Yeah, I do. The radiation particularly was quite hard. The radiation, I would say, was the worst part of it. I had IMRT radiation, which is intensity moderated radiation therapy.
Right.
And it was intense, and it was like, it took 45 minutes to an hour every day.
Oh boy.
And I still have they have like little tattoos on my chest where they would line me up with this light so they could get the exact spot every time. And they could only hit, you know, radiate when I exhaled. So I had to breathe very methodically, and they could only radiate like when I exhaled or when I inhaled, so they could hit the right spot every time. And it made me so sick, sick. I had no energy. And it made everything tight and sore again. So I was doing really good with pain, and it made all the pain come back. But what it did is it really did a number on my nerves on my left side. So my entire left hand is numb. So my vocal cord was paralyzed because of the nerve damage. And this is all stuff that has happened years since, because I had the radiation in 2006.
And how many sessions did you have?
30.
You had 30.
And it just progressively got worse. And what they think is that the myelin sheath got damaged, you know, the covering of the nerves of my brachial plexus nerve, because they had to radiate, you know, they came all the way up to here and did this whole quadrant. Oh, so, but, you know, and just the fatigue, and then, you know, chemotherapy does a number on your brain. Even all these years later, I still have chemo brain where it's like words are just gone.
I guess at some point you realized that you weren't going to be going back to being a hairstylist. That wasn't going to happen. I mean, for, you know, the chemicals alone outside work of it. So
The doctor told me, you can go back to work after 12 weeks. And then, like, at the 3 month mark, I was like, I can barely get through a day without a nap. Like, I'm going to go back to work standing behind a chair.
Right.
Not likely. You know, and I just even cut my mom's hair. And I was so exhausted after just doing one haircut. I was like, there's no way. So, I ended up selling the salon because I was part owner.
Right.
And I sold my shares in the salon and got out of the industry. And I haven't been back to work since.
So the activism you do is mostly volunteer work.
Yep.
But you've become like a really strong voice in the community.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I've been very fortunate in the, you know, my doctor's been a huge, you know, Dr. Sugarbaker was a huge advocate of that. And he got me into a couple of interviews that kind of started everything. And then my law firm reached out to me and said, hey, would you mind doing a blog and we'll host it? And I was like, sure.
Did you sue the company for damages?
We sued multiple companies for asbestos. Yes.
Wow.
So, and that's how the litigation process works, is you find the most likely exposure and you go from there, and then they file lawsuits against the companies. A lot of the companies were bankrupt, so there's bankruptcy trusts that they file against, and you get, you know,
you know, a little
2%
bit
of, you know, you get this value of this bigger. Yeah. So
when did you file suits against them?
We filed suits right away. We, you know, I started looking into it the minute I found out I was diagnosed with mesothelioma. Like anybody does, I was up at 1 o'clock in the morning, not able to sleep. So I went online and looked up mesothelioma.
Right.
And 99% of the websites out there are law firm sponsored.
Right.
They have the money to buy them. Like the most expensive, this is funny, the most expensive Google search is mesothelioma lawyer in Florida.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh my God.
That's like the highest, that's the most expensive.
That's really funny. So, you know, yeah, all those old people in Florida, like finding these, you know, high-end lawyers.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can you say the name of the law firm?
Yeah, it's Early Lucarelli Sweeney and Meissen Colton.
Oh, wow.
Which is a big mouthful, I know.
Yeah.
But the morning, so I filled out this form at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then next morning at 10 o'clock, Jennifer Lucarelli, who's a partner in the law firm, called me. And she was like such a breath of fresh air for me. She was the first person, even outside of, you know, any doctors that I talked to, that was encouraging and empathetic. And she was the first person that I talked to that made me go, I can do this. I can beat this. You know, she's like, you're young. You're seeing the best doctor there is. Lawyers get such a bad rap, but really the mesothelioma lawyers are so caring. And I know a lot of them from different firms all over the country. And I have nothing but wonderful things to say. They're compassionate. They really want to do the best they can for the client.
So have you gotten some money out of this?
Yeah, we had to go to court. It was over 2 years after I filed. Because they had to do a lot of homework and a lot of digging and a lot of, you know, research. But it was 2 years. We actually ended up going to court. They settled 2.5 days in.
Oh, wow.
And we took it. And I did not want to have a long court fight. I didn't. There's a chance you could always lose.
Yeah.
You know, because there was a jury there. And so they offered us a settlement that it wasn't a slap in the face, nor was it, you know, we weren't rich. We still live in a very small little house. And we never moved to a big mansion or anything like that. Or, you know, we just stayed here. And it felt good. But, you know, it's like, thank God somebody's working for the victim.
Well, I mean, it's an acknowledgement of guilt when they give when they give you money. I mean, they don't have to say that or write it down in a legal document. But it is. So, so you got like a decent amount of money.
We got a few settlements. We got, you know, the main settlements, and we get bankruptcy trust every so often.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage every mesothelioma victim to file a lawsuit with a reputable law firm and hire a firm that knows what they're doing, that is educated.
What's the likelihood of recurrence with this kind of cancer? I mean,
very high.
Oh, it
very
is.
High. Yeah. So I'm one of the rare ones that has not, knocked on wood, had a recurrence. And it's not like typical cancer, like 5 years you're free. It's like, oh, after 5 years you're good, I'll never come back. That's not the case usually with mesothelioma.
Really?
A lot of times it will reoccur within the first 18 months after treatment.
I see. Okay.
So it's very, very aggressive. The cell type has a lot to do with it. Like sarcomatoid is the most aggressive and the least responsive to treatments.
Mm-hmm.
I had epithelial, which is the best of the worst cancer.
Oh, really?
You know, it's epithelial cell type, and it's the most responsive to treatment.
Right.
So, you know, it's like there's a number of factors that I think led to my survival.
Mm-hmm.
Quick diagnosis, for one. I was diagnosed within 2 months. Quick intervention with a specialist.
Right.
And seeing a specialist is vital because, you know, Dr. Joe down the street who operates on lungs probably isn't going to know how to do, you know, what they need with mesothelioma because there's so much danger of spreading the cancer when you open somebody up.
Right, exactly.
So to have a surgeon that's well-trained and knows how to deal with the cancer, the right therapies, you know, I think the heated chemo had a lot to do with it more than anything, although other people have it and it doesn't work for them. So I responded well to it. So good medical intervention with the specialist, aggressive medical treatment.
Right.
And my age, I was young.
Yeah, so that, I was that, that able, seems like to fight it. Yeah, just had a lot of resistance to it.
Yeah.
Do you have anything? Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you'd like to add?
I've learned a lot in these last, almost 17 years of doing advocacy, and what works and what doesn't. And what does work? Having a supportive community, even if your case is not good and things don't work out like they did for me, having a specialist and having a community to work with is amazing. And there's a nonprofit that I volunteer with. Mm-hmm. That provides that community for people. And that's the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you involved in founding that?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's been around for a while.
Yeah. I think 2001.
Yeah.
2002.
That's what I saw online. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but I've been volunteering with it for many, many, many years. So when I've raised money and stuff.
Fundraising and.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cancer Horizons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cancer Horizons podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter @cure_magazine or at Facebook @curemagazine.